Welcome to the Atom CTO podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm here with my co-founder, Sam Noble. Say hello, Sam.
Hey, hello.
And what we're talking today about is blockchain. So we're doing a blockchain 101. What is blockchain? And this is the first in a series of podcasts that we'll be doing that kind of explains a little bit, not only about what we do, but different technology areas and kind of demystifies some of the more complex areas of technology. So blockchain being one of them. So Sam, tell us a little bit about your experience with blockchain. You're obviously the CTO of EOS Dublin, a position you gained after working through Atom CTO. So give us a little bit of, bit of overview of, what your experience with the blockchain is. And then if you can answer the $1 million question, what is the blockchain? And hopefully try and describe that in a way that, my dad could understand. That would be perfect.
Yeah, sure thing. So I guess I've been kind of deeply ingrained and involved in blockchain for the past 2 years now, starting off working with a chap called Sharif in EOS Dublin, where we positioned ourselves as a block producer on the EOS network, which you look at Bitcoin or Ethereum or other blockchain networks, we'd be called a validator on the node or a miner. So we're producing blocks on a bunch of different networks, and it's very unexciting. The majority of that work just involves running infrastructure and hardware. It's really quite complicated in the sense that we have pretty large data volumes flying around, and we need to be highly available. So everything has to be running 24/7 without failures, because if your machines aren't running, then blocks aren't being produced, and that impacts the blockchain. So that's kind of half of what we do day to day, is maintaining an infrastructure and producing blocks on various networks. And then the other side of that is obviously building stuff on blockchains that we operate, and, helping businesses understand how they can leverage blockchain in their existing processes or new processes to make life easier for themselves, which I guess flows nicely. So plays nicely into the next bit of what is blockchain and how can we use it? Well, I guess simply blockchain is a distributed ledger. It's as simple as that. So, we have, like in accounting, you have a ledger where things come in and things go out. You have transactions against an account, against some resource, could be money, the currency, and everybody has a copy of this ledger. So you can all compare and all come to agreement on what the actual balance of an account should be.
All right, so let's break that down a little bit, because there's quite a few terms that you've used in there that I think when someone's listening may not really quite understand. So let's start at the very basics, right? So when we talk about blockchain and you talk about producing blocks, what is a block? And if we're looking at, is the blockchain literally a chain of blocks? And if so, what are the blocks?
What is a block? That's pretty much the same across all of the various blockchains. And a block is effectively the product or the outcome, the result of a series of transactions. So at some point in time, and that point in time will change across the blockchains, but I'll use EOS as the example. So every half a second, a new block is produced. So every 500 milliseconds, a node operator, a block producer on the network, will receive a bunch of transactions. And those transactions could be something like transfer 5 EOS from Sam to Bhairav, or it could be executing an action in a smart contract, which ultimately a transfer is also an action on a smart contract. It's a special kind of transaction. So we roll up all of these actions into a transaction. Multiple transactions are then executed, and the output of those is built up into this block.
All right.
Each of the in the chain have a reference to the block before them, which this is how we get this immutability and the idea that the blockchain can't be edited very easily.
So that's the chain part of the block, right? So linking everything together.
Exactly.
Right? So then, okay, let's just take a little bit of a step further up, because I think, again, there's probably a few things in there that you said that may not be as transparent to other people as to, let's say, you and I. So what you're saying essentially is that the blockchain starts off as a network of nodes, and each of those nodes are people like yourself that are producing blocks.
Correct.
Right. So they're producing blocks and they're receiving from wherever. Now, when you say receiving transactions, what I guess to explain to people, a transaction is, again, it's like writing something into a book, right? Now, you can either do that by physically writing it in, or let's say if you're in the zero world, it's scanning in an invoice or whatever it is. Something happens in the real world, and that is then translated into a message, essentially, that is sent to the network to say, this thing happened. And then, so when you talked about different nodes validating it, what does that mean?
So quite simply, let's say we have a transaction and I want to send you 5 EOS. So I will create a transaction that says, okay, Sam is sending 5 EOS to Bayrav. I will sign that so that we know that it was me who invoked that transaction. And then I will submit that to the network. I will submit that via an API call and say, okay, EOS network, whichever the chains I'm running on, I want to execute this transaction. So this transaction gets received, and the transaction, along with a bunch of other transactions, is executed by one of these block producers. So we can talk a little bit how the kind of network topology exists or is defined a little bit later. But the idea is one of these node operators receives a bunch of transactions. They execute all of these transactions and come up with a result at the end of it, which is a basic mathematical proof, which other people on the network, other block producers within the network, they also execute the same set of transactions, and then they compare their answers. Now, this is very specific to the EOS network, where we have a delegated consensus mechanism. But out of 21 of these operators on the network, we need a consensus. So everybody performs the same calculations and everybody compares their answers. If we have a consensus, so if, 2/3 of the network all agree on the same answer, then, okay, this transaction is valid, or this block is valid, so we add it to the chain. If we can't agree, then something went wrong. Either there was a fork in the network, or someone's trying to do something naughty, so we discard that block and we reprocess it.
Okay, so again, just to kind of simplify things a little bit here for people. Now, what we're saying is that you want to send me some money, and that transaction gets delivered to the network along with a bunch of other transactions. And then what you're saying is that there's a mathematical algorithm that's run in order to validate that transaction. But why? What is the purpose of that? What does that give you? If I say to you, Sam wants to give me £5, why do I need this? So basically, let's say, for example, if this was a normal database, that £5 transaction happened and you'd store just that information. In the data that £5 has left your account and £5 been added to my account, right? And that's essentially the ledger transaction that you want to achieve. So the question then becomes is that why do you need to have this consensus? And why do you need to run complex algorithms to know that this transaction took place? I mean, is this, what added benefit do you get from running this consensus node? Why do other people need to be involved?
Yeah. So ultimately, the whole underpinning kind of ethos of blockchain technology is that you're decentralizing trust. So you're removing that need to trust any one specific actor in a network. So in a traditional transaction, you are trusting the bank, or you're trusting whoever you're paying, the payment provider. You're handing over some information to them. You're relying on them in a very opaque manner. This is just a black box where they are saying, okay, we are taking care of whatever you have asked us to do. Now, the only way that you know the inner workings of this is by seeing what goes in and what comes out. So I say, okay, let's send £5 to your account. That happens in some weird and mystical manner. And at the other end, it says, okay, now you, Bayrav, in your account, that you see that you have £5 received from me. This means that we have to trust this entity. We have to trust these people in the middle. So what happens if I submit that £5 to them and it gets lost before it reaches you? Or that company goes bankrupt before it reaches you, or something happens along the way. You have no real way of seeing what is happening where, when, and why. You're completely dependent on the actors involved. So blockchain removes all of that need to trust these black boxes. Everything is out there in the open. Everything is publicly verifiable. And because we're using a consensus mechanism, everybody agrees that I sent you £5. So that kind of prevents a lot of these different attacks where I try to spend that £5 twice, that same £5. So let's say that I promise you £5 and I promise Bob £5 and I promise you both at the same time. in a typical transaction, you know, who receives that first? Because with the banking systems, when they're running through the all of the transactions for the day, adding up the balances, it could look like both of you received £5. When they come to reconcile the accounts at the end of the day, they realize that actually that was a double spend. So only one of you will get that £5. Now, Bob thought he had £5 in his account, but actually he doesn't. This causes a huge problem.
So then the next question, I guess, for, from my own point of view is, why do we trust the network? And how can you have, if it's a simple mathematical algorithm that's being run, how can it produce different results?
How can it produce different results?
Well, how can it have not have a consensus? Because essentially, if I'm giving you £5, how would you get, and I'm saying I'm giving you £5, why would another part out of 10 nodes, if you're saying you need 2/3 majority and 6-7 say, yes, he has sent £5 or he's sending £5, why would the other three say no, that £5 is not being sent? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And why would anyone do that? It's malicious intent. So let's say there is a producer on the network, and you know, as a block producer in this network, and this is a note, but next time we can clarify some of this terminology up front. Somebody who is producing those blocks, you are trusting them to take the data you submitted that says, I am Sam, I'm sending this money to Bhairav. And we give that to them. Now, there's nothing really to stop them from changing the destination account to somebody else.
Right.
They could change the destination account to themselves. If that happens, you know, we have a few checks and balances in place ahead of that to make sure that doesn't happen. But, you know, they could do some naughty stuff there. Now they will have a different outcome to everybody else, because everyone else will say, well, that's not the answer we got. So if they looked at the series of calculations that led up to that, they would spot there was a difference. So that's where the consensus comes into it, because now you're sure that 15 other people have also come to the same answer, and you know that that money is going to move to the right place.
Right. So I think if that's a great example, because essentially what we're doing here is you're highlighting the fact that actually instead of one source of truth, there are many sources of truth in that sense. And so as you said before, if I'm in a simple example of me sending money, if I send it, if I'm buying something from you and let's say I'm buying a car from you and I'm going to send you the cash and I say, I've sent it, and you say, I haven't received it. And I say, look, here's my bank statement. And then you talk to the bank and say, well, we've not received the money. You don't know who to believe, right? However, in this situation, if I send the money and you don't receive it, you can actually see, well, it went to this place, and then from this place, it should have gone to that place. But that transaction never happened. So let's say, for example, it should have been deducted from my account and then added to your account. So it could have been deducted from my account, but that second hop of being added to your account didn't happen. And then we can see that. And that's essentially what you're trying to say. That's the benefit of the blockchain, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And this happens in a much shorter time frame as well. So with a bank, it'll be, you know, 24 hours, depending on which country you're in. And here, all of this happens virtually instantaneously.
So I think...
Where this becomes even more interesting, so, you know, the idea of sending money around is pretty interesting, but we have kind of solved that before. Where this becomes really interesting is the idea of authenticity or fidelity. So when these transactions take place, you know that it was me who sent that money and nobody else. There's a cryptographic signature on there that says, that was me, Sam Noble. So if it wasn't me, then somebody gained access to my keys and they were able to sign this on my behalf. So it's a very secure way of knowing that somebody did something and when they did something. So the applications for this become really big. So if we look at shipping and logistics, and you have an IoT device that's sitting on a container generating GPS data. If we can take that data and sign it before it leaves that device, we know for sure that that data came from that device. We can trace it back. That data is then sent to the blockchain. We can trace it all the way back. We have that kind of full audit record. We don't have to trust any single person to say, where did this data come from? We have all of the information there to follow that paper trail.
Okay, so I guess the next question really is, so this, obviously we understand a little bit around, you know, what the purpose of the blockchain is and how it acts and how it interacts. I guess most people's initial knowledge of the blockchain is going to be Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And I don't really want to go talk too much about that, but I guess what we can do for the benefit of people is understand is, you know, why, you know, okay, what is a cryptocurrency quickly, and why has that been taken over the world? When actually, when you're talking about logistics and moving money, it seems to me that there's a way more applications of the blockchain than just a cryptocurrency that moves up and down because people produce blocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, cryptocurrency was one of the first applications of blockchain because it made the most sense. If we think of blockchain as a distributed digital ledger, well, it's really good for tracking money. So I think, you know, the original idea of Bitcoin was that it was a way of decentralizing or creating a currency that wasn't reliant on government, could be manipulated as easy. But basically, you didn't have to have trust in somebody else to look after that for you. It was in the hands of everybody. So that was just a nice application, and that's what made it famous. It became really huge, and we built this whole kind of ecosystem around it, and that stuck for a while. Now, what we've started to see over the last few years is that as the technology becomes a little bit more familiar to people, people are starting to understand that it's not just the currency aspect that is valuable here. There's that whole kind of audit and immutability that is a lot more interesting.
So there are a lot of different blockchains out there. You've got Ripple, Ethereum, obviously EOS, and then there's a huge number of other chains that have come up, exploded over the last couple of years. So in a sense, why are there so many different blockchains out there? Because obviously, from what we're describing, it seems like a very straightforward set of transactions that you need to actually accomplish. And it's doing a very, I wouldn't say a simple thing, but it's doing one thing well. Why do we need lots of different types of blockchains?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And ultimately, it comes down to different requirements. So if we think of blockchain as a tool, so, you know, if we think about software development, within software, we have myriad different programming languages. Each of those languages can generally do the same kind of stuff. You can write applications that you can, you know, give input and get output, and it will perform calculations, but they'll all do it in a slightly different way. And they'll be slightly better at certain tasks than others. It's very similar with blockchain. So each of the different chains we have will be kind of tailored for a specific use case. You have some pretty generic ones. So, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, EOS, they're all, you know, relatively generic and that they're able to perform transactions. Then you have some that are a little more tailored. So IOTA, this is tailored more for IoT devices, where we have lots of very small, low power devices where we need to be able to handle lots of transactions per second. But we're not so concerned about some of the things that we are in other blockchains. So, you know, in Bitcoin, it's really just about the currency, whereas in IOTA, it's more about the IoT data and less about tracking currencies around the system. So it's really just each blockchain will have it'll be slightly better at certain applications than others. A blockchain like EOS aims to be relatively generic, where the difference there was the consensus mechanism. So how does the network agree that a transaction is legitimate? That comes down to your consensus mechanism. And again, each of these have trade-offs with each other, but it's literally just like having a toolbox.
So that makes a lot of sense. I think, as you say, the analogy for programming languages is pretty much there. I mean, why do we have 1,000 million JavaScript frameworks, right? When one should really do. And you know, there's obviously things like performance and ease of use and all that kind of stuff that gets in there. So I guess what we're moving into now is really the question around how businesses can apply blockchain. And obviously, given the fact that there are a number of different blockchains out there, it must be very confusing to businesses once they're trying to figure out, you know, what should they use. So I guess from your perspective, when you're talking to companies about using blockchain what kind of advice do you give them? I mean, I know when I'm talking to a company about blockchain, I tell them that, you know, unless they need to use one of the features of the blockchain, there's no really need for them to be on the blockchain. But I mean, how do you as a, you know, blockchain specialist deal with companies when they come to you and say, like, I want to put this on the blockchain?
Yeah, so I guess it's like any other kind of conversation around tech. You really have to understand what they're trying to achieve and how they're trying to achieve it, and then just, you know, make the best match. Similar with, you know, if somebody wants to develop a application for iPhone, they generally won't come to you and say, I need this to be native, or this can be built in React Native or Ionic or any of the other frameworks. Instead, we'll have a conversation and figure out, okay, what do you need this app to do? does it need to be a AAA title video game, or does it have to have some really funky graphics and smooth, slick animations? In that case, then you probably need to go for a native application. But if you don't need all of those things, we can abstract away and be a little bit more generic. So it's a similar conversation with blockchain. You know, what are you trying to achieve out of this? What is your use case? And then we'll figure out the best application.
So what kind of, I mean, again, if you are talking to a business, what are the key features of the blockchain that they should be exploiting? You touched on a couple of that, immutability and consensus. But what are the key, if I'm a business owner listening to this now and thinking, well, I've considered the blockchain, what are the key features of the blockchain people should be looking to exploit?
So I guess really immutability is right up there, and decentralization of trust, which a lot of the, and we have to, again, you know, think about the viewpoint of the user in each of these blockchains. So most of the chains, when they were created, it was this kind of very nice, lovely utopian dream where we can, you know, just everyone agrees on everything and decentralized trust. We don't need the banks and the governments and, you know, all of these good people who come along and make life very difficult for us. We can kind of figure it out on our own and decentralize all of that. But that doesn't really apply so much to big enterprise. Where in big enterprise, if we need, let's say, auditing on all of our records on our database, we have built auditing frameworks in traditional relational databases. But if one of your employees has access to a server that your database is running on, they have the ability to manipulate those records. With blockchain, it's still possible, but it's so very difficult that it's improbable. So it's possible, but it's improbable that it'll happen, because it takes so much effort, and you wouldn't be able to do it without colluding with a lot of people, and you know, the whole thing just becomes a lot harder. So it really comes down to that. If you need assurances that the data hasn't been manipulated, or if you work in an environment where you need to decentralize that trust, you can't trust anybody around you, so you have to rely on some kind of a consensus mechanism, this is a good application for it. We also have other systems. So before Bitcoin was even created, the idea of proof of work is what Bitcoin operates on, where you have to do some really complicated mathematical computations, which take a lot of time in order to be able to do something. You know, this was introduced in email as a spam filter. So every time you wanted to send an email from the server, you had to generate a hash that met some certain requirements. And this would take, you know, a minute to do that. So it reduced the amount of spam, because if everybody sending email through the server had to do these computations, they physically can't send as many emails every minute. So this is the kind of the viewpoint you would approach that from.
Right. So I guess that is very interesting, because then I think a lot of the discussions that we've had with businesses, you know, you kind of say to them, well, actually, if you're not using any of these features, then and you don't need this level of trust, or you don't need this level of consensus, or whatever it is, then it's not, you don't need to invest that money. Now, one question that came has come up quite regularly is that, okay, the data is immutable once you've put it onto the blockchain, but how do you know the validity of the data once it's on the blockchain? So how do you know that, for example, in our example, I was not sending £6 instead of £5, and for some reason someone said I'm putting £5 onto the message was £5, and that £1 got pocketed before it even hit the blockchain?
Yeah, so there, and it's a really great question as well. This is all around the kind of security of things. So if we think about this, the end-to-end process, so there's a transaction or an action that's originating from you or from me. So let's say I'm sending you this £5. So in order to push this to the network, I have to create a transaction that I then use a password. I use my private key to sign this transaction before it leaves my control, before it leaves my computer or my iPhone or whatever. So this transaction has been signed, which, you know, again, we apply a mathematical function to the transaction, and that gives us a number at the end. So every time you apply that same function to the transaction, you will get the same number. Now, if somebody tries to modify that transaction, it'll come out with a different number. So it's very difficult for somebody to fake a transaction or to manipulate it once it has been signed. Now, this, of course, makes it very important that you trust the software you're using to do this signing for you. So this is where we have an ecosystem of support and tools for holding onto our passwords or our cryptographic keys. These are generally called wallets. So you'll have a wallet from a reputable company, which, you know, would have been vetted and verified and various security checks, because you are giving the data to this wallet in order for them to sign the transaction for you. So it is very possible a malicious actor could take that data and they manipulate it before they sign it for you. Now you're in that situation where the transaction isn't exactly what you requested. It has been changed. So there is still due diligence and security protocols we have to follow here.
So really what we're saying here is that, okay, as a company or any kind of individual looking to get involved with the blockchain, firstly, you need to understand what it is you want to get out of the blockchain, but also when you are getting involved, you need to make sure that there's enough due diligence done on the people that are involved in the transaction, that you can be secure that information being spread through is correct and verified.
Absolutely. And that's where this, the whole kind of the workflow changes once we get into large enterprise. So, you know, when we're looking at the various EOS chains that are around there, and you have end users sitting at home, you know, playing dice games or doing their own transactions, the security is still important, but it's not, it's a very different set of a different challenge to in an enterprise. So there within enterprise, you can kind of abstract some of this stuff away, because most enterprises will have their own security protocols in place, and they'll have their own protocols for authenticating users. So whether it's biometric with fingerprints or iris scanning, obviously we have usernames and passwords and multi-factor authentication. You can still have those systems in place. Now, once that user has been authenticated, they are now able to use that identity to sign these transactions. So you can kind of create this bridge in between the two. So, you know, for a large enterprise who wants to adopt blockchain, to the end user, it's no different to them just signing in the way they always do. It just means now they have authenticated themselves to use this other channel.
So is developing on the blockchain expensive?
Yes and no. It's expensive in as much as it's still a relatively new technology. So that means that there's not a huge amount of people who are building this. You know, to be honest, in blockchain, if you've been doing blockchain development for a year, you're almost an expert. Because, you know, some of the chains like EOS it's only a year and a half old in terms of the time it's actually been running out in the wild. The technology has been around for a couple of years. But there's not a lot of people who have, you know, that kind of really in-depth experience. So, you know, it's supply and demand. There's not a lot of people who are doing it. So therefore, the competition is quite high. So it can be quite expensive. But again, it depends on what you're trying to build. Because as we've seen with most of the projects, the blockchain aspect is relatively small. Because if you think about it, there's a huge amount of resource constraints on running something on the blockchain. You're limited by the amount of data you can store. The more data you want to store, the more expensive it becomes. Processing speeds, okay, EOS is one of the fastest blockchains. We're running around 10,000 transactions per second, and we're producing blocks every half a second. But that's still half a second. 500 milliseconds is a long time in a lot of systems. You know, if we're running in a trading platform, we're doing some real-time trading, 500 milliseconds is a pretty long time. So you don't always run everything in the blockchain. You'll have a lot of stuff offline, off-chain, and then some kind of synchronization. There'll be these kind of small touching points for the super critical stuff that will happen on-chain. And, you know, this could be taking a patient record, taking all of the data and creating a hash of that. That hash is what you store on the blockchain, because now you have something, a point of reference to verify and validate whether that data has been changed or not, without actually storing all of that data on the chain.
Right. So, I mean, there's definitely not going to be any blockchain spaceships flying around anytime soon.
Not yet. Give it a couple of years.
So if I'm looking to undertake a project on the blockchain, what kind of skills would I need to hire in order for that to happen? As you say, the I guess the, like 10% of the work is done on the blockchain. So for that 10%, is it worth me hiring internal skills to deal with that? Or can I cross-train someone who's already within my company? Or should I just look to find some experts or a consulting business that can do that blockchain piece?
Yeah, and again, there's no real simple answer to that. I guess you can use the same comparison to building an application. Let's say you want to build an iPhone application for your company. Should you go out and hire iOS developers? Should you go out and train people in iOS? So, you know, there's a lot of variables. How much time do you have? What's your budget for this? Because if you need to do this by next week, it's going to be very difficult to go out and recruit that person to do it. Then you would need to get an agency involved. But if you're a startup, you've just received your funding, and you know, you're about to build the latest and greatest distributed application, then it's probably in your best interest to go out and try and hire the people. In terms of, you know, what do you look for when you're hiring somebody? Generally, it's a lot better to have somebody who has blockchain experience. Somebody who has experience writing smart contracts. Doesn't really matter which blockchain, because, you know, we face similar issues across all of the chains. And as I mentioned before, we're heavily constrained by the resources available to us. So something we've seen in the software development world over the years, as machines have become more powerful, as storage has become cheaper, as memory has become cheaper, you know, people become lazy because we don't have to be, you know, super optimal about the code that we write. That all changes once you hit blockchain. Now every byte of data counts. So when you're designing your tables in your smart contracts, or you're designing your actions, you have to minimize this to, you know, the smallest amount of bytes possible. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a different skill set. If you've come through the traditional channels of education and you've sat and, you know, done your degree in computer science or mathematics, you have a much better understanding of this. Whereas if you're kind of coming at it from more of the high level web development world as a self learner, which, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this approach, but you probably don't have that same basic fundamental understanding of how machines work, how compilers work, or how chipsets work. So you'll have a bit of a challenge trying to adapt.
So in a sense, some of the older generation like me, who, you know, started off with C and some of the more machine languages, were probably best placed to understand how that all works when you've got working with low memory back in the day, right? And low processing speed. Yeah. You mentioned smart contracts, and that's something I realized that we haven't really talked about. What are smart contracts, and how are they used? Because you hear a lot about people saying, oh, we can do this in smart contracts. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so I mean, a smart contract is just an algorithm. It's just a recipe. I guess what makes smart contracts special is that they are autonomous. And this is where the real power of blockchain comes in. Now, if we start off with Ethereum was the first blockchain to introduce the concept of smart contracts. So a smart contract is just, you know, a method or a function you would have in normal code, but it exists on the blockchain and it's immutable. So once you've developed it and published it for the Ethereum blockchain, it sits there forever. If you want to upgrade it later, you remove the old one and put a fresh version up. So this now gives you this really powerful, computer where, based on some inputs, it will always, you know, give you these outputs. So a great example of this would be in an insurance payout. So you have a set of conditions coming into the smart contract. It will analyze those conditions and make a decision on something. So if we integrate it into the concept of IoT, let's say that, you know, we're shipping some produce that's in a refrigerated container. My insurance policy says that if the temperature or the humidity inside that container exceeds some thresholds, the produce is ruined and a claim should take place. Now, in the traditional world, if your container is moving around on the ship, you have to trust that some guy on the ship is going around taking these readings. Everything is being monitored and then it will be reported back later. Now, as you can imagine, there's a lot of money at stake here, because if a container full of produce gets ruined, somebody has to pay for that. Your insurance premiums will go up. If we have data being sent to a smart contract with no kind of human interaction in between, that contract will decide when any of those constraints have been violated. If the temperature went 2 degrees over, smart contract would receive that information. The smart contract can then make a payout based on that. So they can be really quite simple, just a set of rules. If this happens, do this. But because it's decentralizing that trust, you don't rely on a person. It's written in code, and code that can be audited and verified and, you know, peer reviewed, so that you know it's safe and secure and it's going to be what it says.
So it is really a contract there in the sense that, let's say, for example, that you gave just there, right? I would assume that if I was an insurer, I would want to delay paying out as much as possible in order to kind of keep the cash internally, make money off that. But in this sense, the insurance company with whoever it is, logistics provider, whatever it is, would then have that contract to say, look, okay, we agree that if you send us this information, we will pay you within X amount of days based on the trigger that is creative. So that's actually the contract there. You would need two parties really to agree to the actions being taken, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And within some of the networks, I mean, EOS is one of them, where every smart contract comes along with a thing called a Ricardian contract. Ricardian contracts were developed in the 90s by a guy called Ian Grigg, a really smart guy, been a big proponent in the EOS world. And a Ricardian contract is basically a very simple, plain English explanation of what the smart contract is doing. And so it gives you this kind of code version of the contract, an English version of the contract, which makes it a lot easier to integrate that into your own legal contracts. Because obviously, you know, you can't expect your lawyer to sit there and read code, but they can read the letter of intent of a smart contract. So that makes it a very powerful thing, because now you can bring this into your policy. And then an advantage for something like the insurance companies where, okay, they have to process a claim and do a payout. Instead of having a team of people sitting there processing claims and managing those payouts, you've effectively automated that now, because the data is coming from a place that is trusted and known. It's signed so that when we receive the data, we know it hasn't been tampered with. So that kind of eliminates that whole feedback loop.
So I guess one thing to stress here is that smart contracts are transparent if you're on a public blockchain, right?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, it's still possible that you can build a smart contract and push it up to the blockchain without ever telling anybody, you know, what it's doing. You can go and reverse engineer the contract. It's not very easy, but the same as you can reverse engineer, you know, kind of most software out there in the world. You can get an idea of what it's doing and how it's doing it. But generally, and you know, this is one of the things for the EOS network itself, if you're publishing smart contracts onto the network, you have to at least you know, give some information about it and the source code to it as well.
So you don't really want to have your company secrets or any kind of IP in that contract, right? It needs to be something very simple.
Exactly, yeah. So that's where then you have the case, and this only applies to the EOS main network. You have lots of chains that are operating off the side of this, these kind of private chains or chains run by different entities, which have a different set of rules for them. So if you are a large enterprise wanting to run your smart contracts in a more protective manner, then you would use one of these side chains, you know, such as Europe Chain, which was a chain we created, GDPR-based, European-based block producers. It's a whole different set of rules geared towards large enterprise.
So I guess the question there becomes, okay, so there, I think I've touched this on this with another podcast, actually with Evan from Ocean, around public and private blockchains. So we don't necessarily need to go into that, but obviously they're two different worlds. But if you're a business, is there not, I mean, given the technology is very new, is there not still a risk that adopting a certain chain now and building something that relies on that chain is, and that chain could go away, right? There's no guarantee that that chain can exist. So, you know, how would you understand which is the right chain? You know, are they viable? Will they exist the next number of years' time? And if something does disappear, you know, what would happen to that data? I mean, is that something that can be easily accessed? I mean, I guess an enterprise looking at it would be looking at those kinds of risks, right? And so how would they evaluate those risks?
Yeah, a really great question. How do you de-risk any service that you use? How do we de-risk Bitbucket when it first came about? You know, they were just some small entity that allowed you to host your code on there. Okay, then they were bought out by Atlassian and it became a bigger thing. But there's the same principle. If it's a very small, shady operation who just started up 2 days ago, you're probably not sure they're going to be there in a year. Whereas if you have a company who are approaching this as a legitimate venture, they have all of the things in place as any other legitimate company would have, that mitigates some of that risk. So when we're looking at a blockchain like EOS, we're kind of talking about two different things. One is the software itself. The other is the people running that software, the networks. So if we look at the software itself, this would be the equivalent of looking at a programming framework like React. So Facebook, some years ago, built React JavaScript framework to speed up and improve the developer experience for developing their own application. They thought that this could be valuable to other people and win some brownie points, so they open sourced this and allowed it for everyone. For a long time, Facebook always said that, you know, we don't guarantee that this is going to be around forever, so use it at your own risk. But it was Facebook behind it, so you know they weren't going to disappear overnight. Similarly, with the EOS blockchain, we have Block 1 behind it. Now, you know, famously, they had their $4 billion investment raise, or their token sale just over 2 years ago. It's a very large company who, you know, they're not going to go anywhere. So we have a lot of support and assurances that the EOS.io software is going to be around for some time. Now, the EOS main network itself, yeah, that could disappear overnight, or, you know, any of these other sidechains could disappear overnight. So then you have to look at who are the people running this, who are the entities behind it, you know, what they look like, who are they employing, just the same as any other service. If you're trying to find a new backup provider to back up all of your photos to, you want to make sure they're going to be around. Now, the difference there would be, if you're using a backup provider to store all of your photos and that backup provider goes under, you've lost all of that data. You have no way of accessing it. Whereas with these blockchains, because they are effectively open, in as much as any of these networks, you are able to get a copy of that transaction log. So you're able to get a copy of the blockchain. If you have that copy of the blockchain, you have that history, you have that data there. So everybody in the world can have their own copy of it. So if the original people who started that chain and were running it disappeared, you still have your own copy of it.
Right. So that's good to know. So then that's a huge, as you say, it's a huge way of de-risking it. And it's in many ways better than what you find traditionally out there, because companies get bought, companies disappear, software gets mothballed, all of that kind of stuff happens. So I guess my last question for you is around the crypto millionaires, right? So when do we all become blockchain millionaires? You hear all these people raising huge amounts on coin ICOs and token or coin offerings and all this kind of stuff. You know, is that all real? Is that something that, and can we all become millionaires out of this?
Well, yeah, no, who knows? It's, let's just go back a couple of years to Silicon Valley in the 2000s, right? You know, people were just throwing money around left, right, and center. So if you have a great idea, if you have a way of selling your idea and you can find someone who's willing to give you money for that idea, then yeah, you can become very rich very quickly. It's probably no different to those early days in the Valley, where everyone was raising stupid amounts of money, and it's still happening to some extent, but it's slowed down. You know, the whole crypto scene just became that new hot, sexy thing where, you know, let's just put tons of money in. And as with most of these things, the .NET bubble in early 2000s, it was just hyperinflated, overinvested, overhyped. So a lot of what you see going on is just, you know, smoke and mirrors. There is a lot of hype going around. You know, over the last couple of years, you know, still to this day, I'll attend conferences and people are telling me that EOS is a scam because, you know, they happen to raise $4 billion in the token sale and all of that hype that went around it. If there's too much hype, it can't be real. So you still get a lot of resistance there. But if you can find an investor who wants to give you all of their money, then you can become very rich very quickly. I'm not sure how sustainable that is or how you can sleep at night doing that. It's just another part of business.
On a very nice bed, I'm sure. All right, Sam, thanks for that. It's been very interesting. And hopefully people have found this as a good introduction to blockchain and demystifying all of the, hopefully most of what is out there already.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.